episode 2 of The Minimal Pair, recorded on Monday, February 24th, 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm Jean Dempsey, and this is Stephanie X.
Hi there.
Hi, Stephanie. So, believe it or not, the semester is almost halfway over. And I don't know about you, but between Martin Luther King Day and President's Day and all of the snow days, I'm really feeling the pressure to get everything done in time.
Absolutely. It has been really hectic. I feel like I've had a lot less time to do a lot more work. I know exactly what you mean. And now, heading into midterms, it just feels like there's even more to do.
So what kinds of things are you getting ready to do in your classes? What kind of classes do you teach?
Well, you know, having all different types of classes means I'm kind of preparing in a lot of different ways. I'll tell you a little bit about what I'm teaching right now. I teach a listening and note-taking class, and a lot of times it's for lower-level students at the community college. And then also I am teaching a grammar class, but it's a higher-level grammar class. It's for students getting ready to go into English 101. I'm also teaching an English 101 class that was designed for English as a second language speakers. And then also I have a class that's a writing class that's basically right before the students do enter into English 101.
Wow. So I imagine you are looking at very different types of midterm assessments.
I am. I mean, this semester I'm a little heavy with the writing because the grammar class that I teach, it does have a huge writing component to it. But with the listening and note taking, that's a completely different type of midterm that we would do. And I like to call those the live journals, because throughout the semester, what we will do is every week students have to turn in a journal that's written based on a video that they watched. And so they can watch the video as many times as they want at home, and then they write a journal that includes an introduction, a summary, a process, basically describing, you know, how many times did they have to listen to it, was it difficult, how long the video was, and then an opinion section, so what they thought about the video. So at midterm, I basically do what I call the live journal, and I show them a video that they have not seen yet. I show it to them twice in class, and then they have the rest of the class period to write a journal in class based on the journals they've been writing at home.
Wow. That sounds like a pretty intimidating thing for them, but I guess that part of the journal that they do at home is reflecting on what was difficult for them and what they can do differently. And so maybe, hopefully, they're kind of working out some strategies for how they can understand better while they're listening.
Yeah, I am putting an emphasis on, you know, relying on their notes. They do get to use their notes during the midterm. So I want to encourage them to take clear notes in an organization pattern that works best for them, since it is a listening and note-taking class. I do feel like that's a pretty big component. But also, I want them to be able to more quickly be able to pick apart the important parts of a video and, you know, the key words that people are saying. So I feel like, you know, this kind of puts the crunch on them. It shows them that, you know, they do have to continue getting better at it, because at this point, most students are passing every journal that they turn in every week. And they really do have to show that they can maybe do it a little more quickly.
So typically, how many times do they have to listen to the videos when they do their journals at home?
Some 2 to 3 times. But I mean, I've graded journals where they said that they listened to it 6 or 7 times. Wow. So really, depending on the speaker or listener, they may have to listen to it a few times. And sometimes it can take several hours for them to do one of these journals.
I imagine.
Yeah. Wow. So tell me about one of your midterm your classes and how you kind of run your midterms.
Okay, so I'm also teaching a grammar class, although mine is more at the intermediate level than yours. And I'm also teaching an academic English class, which is likewise at the intermediate level. So my classes are a step below yours. And so I guess I'm probably doing things just a little bit differently. In the grammar class, we actually don't have a midterm. Students have taken one test so far. And ideally, they would have taken their second test right before spring break. but it wouldn't have been a midterm. It wouldn't have been cumulative or worth any extra points. But because of the holidays and the snow days, we've missed 3 class sessions. So we'll have the test when we get back. So basically, to assess them at midterm, I'll just take an average of the work that they've done so far, which is 2 writing assignments, 3 quizzes, 1 test that covered 2 chapters in the book, and some miscellaneous homework assignments.
Okay. Okay. So it is a little bit different than my grammar class. Mine, it does have that heavy writing component that I already mentioned, and so we've written some essays in class. I also have them write kind of an in-class response that we'll be assessing as well. I call it the weekly 10, where they have to kind of in line with the syllabus expectations of being able to have 80% accuracy by the end of the class. I give them a writing prompt and they have to write no more, no less than 10 sentences. And then I let them know that percentage of what they, you know, how well they did or how poorly they did. So it kind of lets them know where they are in terms of that measurement that's in the syllabus. So we grade that. And then I am doing a midterm exam before, like at midterm this year, where they will be doing, they'll be writing a prompt in response to a prompt in one class, and then the next class they'll come back and they'll have to edit it. And so it'll be worth equal parts because editing is such a key part to, you know, perfecting your grammar, improving your grammar. So I want them to focus on that as well.
I like that. And one thing that we're doing in my grammar class, which hopefully will prepare them well for the next level, regardless of whether they're in your class or not. So for their writing assignments, they usually have to write 4 paragraphs answering 4 different prompts. And each prompt targets whatever grammar point we're working on. So in the first writing assignment, each of the prompts sort of push them to use a different verb tense. Okay. And now in this writing assignment, they're going to be using noun clauses, adjective clauses, and adverb clauses. And what I have them do when they're finished writing is go through and underline all of the verbs or clauses or whatever it is that the grammar target is. Because I find that students can't revise their work if they can't identify the kinds of things that they're looking for. So they can't Right. fix verb tense mistakes if they can't find their own verbs. So I'm really pushing them to be able to identify different things like that in their writing, because I think that by isolating different grammatical points, it makes the revision process a lot less daunting.
Yeah, I really like that approach. I think anytime you can build awareness around, you know, the writer and what how they write, I think that that really adds to the writing experience for them. And I tell my students, I don't expect you to be a perfect writer. I don't expect your grammar to be perfect. But what I expect is that you're aware of your weaknesses and that you're able to go in and fix those weaknesses or find a strategy to help you with those weaknesses as you progress. And so it sounds like them being able to identify the different parts of speech or different, you know, verb tenses, that's one way for them to kind of help mitigate those problems or errors.
Definitely. And I like your idea with the daily 10, because one thing that you said that caught my attention was that you have them write no more than 10 sentences. Right. And that's something that my grammar students have been struggling with. Because it's not a writing class, I'm looking for quality over quantity. I don't want a 5 paragraph essay. I just want a short paragraph answering the prompt. And I would rather see the paragraph shorter with fewer mistakes than longer with all kinds of mistakes. And so I'm working on getting them to be more concise and more accurate.
Good, good. Well, I hope that works out for them in midterm.
I hope so too. And speaking of writing classes, I know we're both teaching academic English classes as well. So slightly different strategy than with the grammar classes, because I think with both of our grammar classes, we're looking for targeting grammatical accuracy, whereas in the writing classes, because our program is fluency first, we're looking at getting their ideas down.
Right.
And grammar is still important, definitely, but sort of takes a backseat.
Exactly. And like you said, you know, with the fluency first model, depending on what level they're at, there are different expectations in terms of like how high percentage of accuracy they have to have. And, you know, we have to treat each of those classes differently based on that requirement or that expectation. And so obviously my class is going, they're expected to have kind of a higher accuracy rate than yours would. And so sometimes that's a big adjustment for them to come from your class and then they complete that and then come into my class where they're expected to focus less on just getting the words out, but focusing more on how do I do this correctly and write a well-structured, developed essay.
Definitely. And I know from last semester when I taught the entry-level academic English class to this semester when I'm teaching the intermediate level, that's a hard transition as well. Maybe yes. A harder one even. Because in that first level class, we really are just encouraging them to write, and get their ideas down. And it's fun and it's creative and it's just all about kind of finding your voice. And then you get to that next level and it's much more intense, more focused. And then, like you said, by the time they get to the third level, it's really fine tuning and polishing.
Right. And so I know that at your level and at our level, we have what we call the portfolio. And so we can give our listeners a little bit of background on that, where basically our students write an in-class essay. They don't have access to the prompt in advance. They come to class, they get the writing prompt, and it's usually related to reading that we're doing in class, because in each of the academic writing classes, we do read books and write about them all semester. So they have, you know, their chance to write this essay in class, and then they have some time at the end of the essay to make some edits. But then the essay is sent to another instructor who also teaches that same course, maybe at a different campus or even at the same campus, and it's sent to that person to review. And so do you want to talk a little bit about maybe the rubrics that we kind of use for that?
Sure. The rubric at the intermediate level breaks the evaluation down into about 7 categories, I think. So the first thing that we check for is just comprehensibility. Can we understand what the reader is trying to, or what the writer is trying to say? Because like you said, we don't expect grammar to be perfect, but if it gets to the point where it interferes with the reader's ability to understand the essay, then that could be a problem. And then there's categories also for organization and structure. So we're really working and pushing that 5-paragraph essay, which I have mixed feelings about, because I know that there's so much more to writing than the 5-paragraph essay. But anyway, it's a good foundation, and I do believe strongly in building that foundation. So we work on the 5-paragraph essay. The next criteria is support. Can we tell from their writing that they've been reading and understanding the book? Then we look at grammar, and like I said, it doesn't have to be perfect. We especially look at verb tense and sentence structure. In my level, and I believe it's 60% accuracy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what about in the upper level?
So it's very similar to what you just described. One addition that I would add is that we do look at the vocabulary, and we look at it in 2 different ways. The first way is, you know, are they basically using words correctly? You know, are they not getting them mixed up? Or were they not using T-H-E-I-R instead of T-H-E-R-E? You know, that has to be solid. But then also we look at, is the vocabulary that they're using, is it appropriate for what they're reading? So if we're reading about Native Americans, are they able to use the word tribe? Are they able to talk about, you know, different key words within the reading? Rather than using a more basic or roundabout type of way of describing what they're trying to say. So that's where we add, and we put a lot more emphasis on that vocabulary, I think, at our level to try to help build those academic words.
And also at your level, don't you focus more on complexity of sentence. Like it, in my level, we look to see is the sentence grammatically correct in terms of is it a run-on, a fragment, is there comma splice? But I believe at your level, we're looking more for the complexity of the sentences.
Right. So we do look at the sentence structure. And of course, there are students who are smart enough to know, like, hey, if I write my complete essay and, you know, I walk the dog is brown, you know, very simple sentences, they think, wow, well, I'm writing them correctly. And most of our students at that level do have that ability to write simple sentences very well. What we're looking for more usage of conjunctions and adding in transition words. And so we are looking for more complex sentences. And as somebody reading an essay, I am much kinder to somebody who is taking a risk. You know, I like a good risk taker. And so I would much rather them see them make a mistake taking a risk than completely nail it with a bunch of simple sentences. So for me, that's what I look at. And I've talked to a lot of other colleagues who feel similarly. They want to see somebody really trying to make a complex sentence and make their writing more interesting to read and have better flow. So yeah, we definitely look at that as well.
Yeah, I like that. I like how one class builds on the next. And I like how the portfolio process is similar enough in both classes, or I should say in all three classes and all three levels, that students kind of know what to expect.
Yeah, the bummer of it for them is that it's pass-fail. And so mostly at midterm, most students do fail. You know, very seldom do I have even half the class pass at midterm. And I try to set them up in that way and say, look, you know, this is a tough, it's a tough time. You have to really buckle down and write well, and you most likely aren't going to pass every section of the rubric. And, you know, that gives us, though, a jumping off point for the rest of the semester.
Do they have to pass every section on the rubric in order to pass their essay?
At midterm, they're considered failing if they fail just one section. So, yeah, they do have to pass everything to pass it. And then even so, you know, I've had a couple of students who've passed every section at midterm, mm-hmm. not very often. And when I do, I still kind of try to set them up to recognize that they still have to pass a similar type of portfolio for final mm-hmm. in order to pass the class. And so this kind of is where our conferences come in. I like to have conferences with my students at midterm to explain to them the areas that they failed or the areas that were weaker so that they know what they need to improve for the final.
Yeah, I like to do that also. I'll have conferences when we get back from spring break where I'll meet with students one-on-one and go over their essay with them. And what I like about the rubric is, like I already described, it's broken down into different categories, which really makes it easy to pinpoint what students need to work on. Because all you have to do is look down the rubric to see where the check marks fall on the pass or the fail side. And it really helps students know what their weakness is.
Yeah. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with having that awareness of what they do need to work on and how they need to improve and
taking ownership.
There have been times, I mean, I had one semester recently where the entire class, they were fine with structure and responding to the prompt and clarity, but where they really struggled was their grammar. So I sent every single student, I told them they had to, based on their own errors, so it might be singular, plural for one person, it might be verb tense errors for another, I sent them to the Writing Center. And I said, hey, I need a note from whoever works with you in the Writing Center, but you need to work on these specific areas, because if you don't improve these at the end of the semester, you'll probably fail the portfolio. And so I've had great success in doing that, even though it's probably created a little extra work for the people in the Writing Center. I know my students have actually found a lot of value in doing that. It kind of gives them a place to go. They know, okay, these are my errors. These are the things I need to improve. And it kind of gives them a plan for doing it. It's like a contract between the two of us.
Yeah, I think that that's a good way of looking at it, because my initial thought was, gosh, that must be really discouraging for a student to see check marks on the fail side at midterm, because they're really hard on themselves and they have high expectations for themselves. But what I like about what you just suggested is that by taking ownership for the mistakes they're making, it's really empowering them. So instead of feeling discouraged, they must feel motivated and empowered to improve and work on the things they need to work on.
I hope so. And it's had positive response. I mean, of course, you get the few students here and there who don't go. You know, they fly in the face of your request and don't go and don't work on it. But then at the end of the semester, a lot of times they're the ones who don't see the progress like the other students do. So, and I also feel like it helps kind of break down that barrier if they haven't gone to the Writing Center before. It's a nice way for them to kind of become familiar with it so that in the future for other classes, other assignments, they feel comfortable going. So
absolutely.
It works really well for me.
Well, I think probably one reason why students don't go is they're so busy. And I know that as instructors, we're really busy too. And especially at midterms, there's just so much going on, especially if you're teaching at more than one school and you're teaching different levels of classes and you're trying to, you know, figure out all of the different assessments that you're going to do. So what do you do, Stephanie, to manage your time and get everything done?
Wow, that is really a great question. As we are approaching midterms, I do have to remind myself, you know, what can I do to keep myself sane and keep myself on track? One of the things I have to do is when I'm grading or trying to prepare is just to get out of the house to do it. It's like go to a cafe or go get a coffee somewhere, go to a park, and really just get to planning and grading. Because if I'm at home, I'm thinking about that laundry that needs to be done, or I'm thinking about, you know, what am I going to make for dinner tonight? And so it's so easy to get off track, you know, and then I feel like, too, oh, it's easier to have maybe a new show on in the background while I'm grading, and then I'm not as focused. So,
wow, I'm impressed, though, because if I'm grading at home, I'm not thinking about the laundry. I'm thinking about, do I want to take a nap on the couch or do I want to read a book? So I think that's a really great idea, getting out of the house. Now, it's not as effective if you get out of the house and go to a coffee shop and meet one of your other adjunct buddies to grade with, because I know we've done that before.
And I don't know what you're talking about.
We end up talking the whole time.
Gene, I've never done that.
I think that we'll probably do that next week.
Okay, you're right. So yeah, I mean, you have to have that discipline to kind of go out on your own and do it. But yeah, what about you? What are some of your top tips for staying focused?
Well, I think I try to prioritize what needs my feedback the most, because students are at this point in the semester turning in regular homework assignments like they always have, like their weekly journal or their smaller assignments that they have on a regular basis. But then they're also writing practice essays in class and at home. And so it's a lot of extra grading for me. And so deciding what I want to spend time on and give a lot of feedback on, can really make it more manageable for me, because in some cases it's suffices just to glance and make sure they're on track and give them a check mark, and you don't have to correct every grammatical mistake that they make and every single thing that they turn in. So limiting myself in that way is really helpful.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And I use lists a lot. I don't know about you, but
I make lists about my lists. Definitely.
Yeah, I have lists in my iPhone, and then I have like the paper list, because there's something for me that's just really satisfying to grab a pen and mark
cross
something
off
the list.
Yeah.
And I don't like to get rid of my list, because I like to see all the crossed off things. Like, I would just rather keep adding things than make a new list, because I feel more accomplished.
Well, and I know that I would rather make a list than actually get down to work. So,
oh yeah,
that's a fun way of procrastinating.
It's like a productive way of procrastinating.
Absolutely.
You feel
really good about,
like,
yourself when you're done with your list.
I've got all this stuff
sometimes
that I'm going to do.
Sometimes I color code my list.
Oh yeah, yeah. I put the date by when I should have it done. And
that's,
yeah,
good.
I mean, there are a million ways that you can procrastinate when building your list.
There are also a million ways that you can manage your time. So hopefully the tips that Stephanie and I came up with are helpful to you. And if you have any other ideas for how to manage time or get through midterms, please don't hesitate to share them with us. We're always looking for ways that we can do better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right.
So, Stephanie, you were talking about how in your academic English class, something that you do differently, or not just you, but something that is done differently at your level than at my level, is building vocabulary. Vocabulary is not a section on our rubric, and it is on yours. So what are some things that you do to build vocabulary in that class?
Sure. Well, the first thing that we do is with their reading journals. They have to read about 50 to 60 pages every week. And with that comes a reading journal where they have introduction, summary, a paraphrase section, and then also a vocabulary section. And one thing I've changed recently, rather than let them just kind of list the vocabulary words that have been giving them trouble, is I will come up with 5 words for everybody to look up and then use in a sentence. And then I expect them to provide 5 more words that they either had to look up or they didn't understand, and they have to use those words in a sentence. So it's not just kind of reciting back the meaning, but it is, you know, using it, actually using it. And this kind of helps test things like parts of speech and word form so that they know, you know, is it being used as a noun now? Is it being used as a verb? And I tell them I will mark off if they don't change the word form. So, for example, if I give them the word abolish, and then they what they mean to say is the abolitionists disagreed with slavery, then they would have to, you know, use the word abolitionists rather than abolish. So that's kind of how that works.
I think that's a really good thing for us to start thinking about in my class too, actually, because although there's no vocabulary section, word form is definitely something that comes into play in that first criteria on the rubric, which is comprehensibility. And if there are a lot of word form mistakes, then students can certainly end up failing comprehensibility.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I do journals also in my class, and they have to look up a word, identify the part of speech, and then give the definition. I don't have them write a sentence in my class, although I have in other classes. So maybe that's something that I could start doing, or I know in the past I've given quizzes where they've had to change, they've identified keywords, or we'll come up with a list of keywords together, and then for the quiz they have to change those words from one part of speech to another.
Oh, okay. I like that. And you know, one thing I do with the lower level class, so now I'm teaching the higher level classes, but I have taught the lower level classes before, and one thing that I'll do, because the focus is on them just being able to kind of like get their words out, rather than, you know, complete accuracy, I'll give them a word, a vocabulary word, and ask them to find photos that kind of represent that word in some way on the internet. And then we'll create some wikis in Blackboard for their word so that they can paste these pictures into the wiki. And, you know, then other students can go and take a look at it and hopefully gain some insight from their classmates' vocabulary words and photos.
I think that's a great way to wean students off their bilingual dictionaries, because mm-hmm. I know that if they see a word and they can picture what it is rather than picturing what it is in their language,
right,
then that helps them move past the bilingual dictionary and get ready for the English-to-English dictionary, which is all that they can use by the time they get to the intermediate level writing classes.
Right. And people do become very reliant on translators and, you know, bilingual dictionaries. And really, I want them to see the value in expanding their vocabulary by finding other ways to get the definition and to actually use the word. So, yeah,
I know one thing that Nancy, one of our colleagues who will hopefully be a guest in the future, one thing that she does is gives the students a list of words and has them guess what the word means based on the context, and then they look the words up there in class. So they're kind of completing that segment of their journal in class. And the reason she does that is to make sure that they're following the process that she wants them to follow, which is try to guess from the context and then see if you're right by looking it up in the dictionary.
I like it. That Nancy, she has some great ideas. I do hope she'll be a guest someday.
She's our grammar guru, so really you can look forward to that.
Yes. Yes. Another thing I'll do, it's kind of game-like, you know, last time I talked a little bit about playing games, and in my family, we like to play a lot of games, especially around the holidays, but one of the games that kind of inspired me in terms of vocabulary was the game Taboo. Are you familiar with that, Jean? I don't know.
No, I know what taboo means, but I'm not familiar with the game. No.
Okay. So true to the definition of taboo, it's about words that you can't say or shouldn't say. And so what happens for the people who are listening, maybe you know, maybe you don't, but the game Taboo, you divide into two different teams and you have someone from your team kind of stand up and they're holding a card, and on the card there is a word. And in the game Taboo, a lot of times it's a kind of a cultural reference or historical reference. And what you have to do is you have to try to get your team to say the word on the card. But the trick is that below the word on the card, there are five related words listed. So for example, if my word were water, if I wanted my teammates to say the word water, below it, words like liquid, blue, drink, swim, refreshing may be listed. I cannot say those words. If I say those words, somebody from the other team, they're going to use this big giant buzzer and buzz me, and then I don't get a point for that card. So what I ask my students to do is I will give them the vocabulary word that perhaps we've gone through, you know, in the book or in a video, and, you know, it's a word that maybe we've already talked about, and I will give them some keywords that they cannot use to describe that word. And so let's say we read a book about Barack Obama. The five words that maybe I would give them would be president, Michelle, Illinois, senator, and tall. On the other hand, it can be stressful. And I've put it on a test. Yeah, I've put it on a test like at the end of the semester when I'm really trying to like push them even further. And they just... they're like, at the end of the, you know, at the end of the class period, they're like, I hated that section, but I learned how to describe it. So, you know, it can really stretch their boundaries in terms of the words that they typically use to describe things.
Wow. We'll have to play that sometime.
Definitely. Maybe we'll have a little on-air taboo session sometime.
That would be a lot of fun.
All right.
I look forward to that.
It would.
What are some other things that you've done to work on vocabulary? I know that you teach a listening, or you've taught a pronunciation class, and this semester you're teaching a listening and speaking and note-taking class. So what are some things that you do in that kind of class to build vocabulary?
Well, I do have in my listening and note-taking class, I do have them use words and sentences. I think for the level that is, I think that's probably as advanced as they can really get with it, because a lot of times there's still... even putting together a complete sentence can be a challenge at that level. So just having them push themselves to use those words and sentences. And also I have them come up with their own vocabulary words. So just recently when we were studying, you know, African-American history, I asked them, you know, what words confused you in this video? And so we put them up on the board, and then their goal with their partners was to define those words. And then I incorporated the words that they picked into the test so that, you know, they felt like they took a little ownership over it. And I feel like when you own something like that, you're maybe more likely to remember it and be able to use it in the future as well.
I really like that for vocabulary journals in the academic English classes as well. I know at the intermediate level, I let them pick their own words. But in the past, when I've taught the advanced level, I gave them five words and then they chose five. That way, I knew that everyone in the class could be held accountable for those five words that I chose. And if I found them using those words wrong in their writing, then I could safely say, oh, you're supposed to know that word because that was in your vocab log.
Nice. They got busted.
Totally.
I bet a lot. Yeah.
So another thing that I do in my writing class, because it's so focused on, like I said, on the five-paragraph essay and developing a strong thesis statement and following through on it, I'll have my students brainstorm a list of words around different topics. So let's say last semester we read a book about a strong female character, and they had to list adjectives about her. So they were working on building their vocabulary, plus it was reinforcing which words were adjectives versus their noun forms. Then They had to find an example in the book for each adjective so that they would have that specific detail to add in their essay. And then finally, they had to pick three of the adjectives and write a three-part thesis statement about the character and what kind of person she was, all in preparation for their end of semester in-class essay, which, of course, would then go through the portfolio committee that we described earlier.
Wow, I like that. I like how it builds, and it kind of shows, you know, how they have to have all of these different skills to be an effective writer. I really like your approach to that.
Yeah, I think that they enjoyed it, too. They had a lot of fun looking for examples, and I think it certainly, by breaking it down in that way, made the essay writing process less intimidating to them.
Great. Adjunct antics.
My favorite section. So last week we talked a little bit about living in your car and what it's like going from school to school and all of the challenges that go with that. And so to kind of build off of that, we're going to talk this week about resources. And so the most obvious thing that comes to mind is the things that we carry with us in our cars from campus to campus. So we have our bags with our mini staplers and our wide out and our flash drive and this and that that we take with us from campus to campus. But of course, resources can also be the things that are provided to us from the school or by the school, as well as online resources. So that's kind of what we're going to delve into today.
Right. Right. And so one of the things that kind of comes to mind for me is, you know, as an adjunct, I've got like all of these different accounts I'm logging into and all of these different passwords I have to remember and logins. And, you know, I used to keep a list and then I accidentally deleted my list and I was kind of frantic. So I try to now, my husband will kill me for saying this, but I try to keep all my passwords the same.
You don't have to tell me that because you made all of our minimal pair accounts, and I know that the password is the same for Twitter and Facebook and Gmail and everything, so you're busted.
I know, I do that, but it's a lot to manage for me to try to keep track of all of that, and on top of it, using the different email accounts, and then using, like, the different Blackboards, because I have noticed that there are differences from campus to campus in terms of how the Blackboard is set up, or maybe they have different versions of Blackboard, so...
Yeah, so listeners, if you don't know what we mean by Blackboard, we're not talking about an actual blackboard or chalkboard that you write on, but Blackboard is an online resource that allows you to post things for your class. So when you log into Blackboard, all of your classes that you teach are listed, and so you can go class by class and post your syllabus and different assignments, and you can keep an online grade book in Blackboard so that students can kind of keep tabs on how they're doing. Students can submit things in Blackboard. You can create wikis like Stephanie described earlier.
Discussion boards.
Discussion board is a fun one, especially I like to use discussion board on days where we miss class for holidays or weather-related things. I'll put something in discussion board. So yeah, Blackboard is a wonderful resource, but it is slightly different from school to school, and that can be something to adapt to.
Exactly. Because then you might have, like at one university, I have to make it active and available for my students. And elsewhere I've taught, I haven't had to do that. And so sometimes I'll forget, and my students come to me and say, I can't see anything on Blackboard, nothing's there. And I'm, I guess I have to make that available to you. I forgot that that's part of what I have to do. So here I have all this content up and ready to go, but it's not been made available to students. So that's something to keep track of for sure.
And similarly to that, one of the schools where I teach, I can log into Blackboard as a student. So I can log in as an instructor or as a student. And that's helpful because then I can see exactly what the students see. But I can't do that at the other school. And so I didn't realize how much I had come to rely on that, checking in as a student just to sort of keep tabs on what they could see.
Right. So yeah, and another area I feel can be different from school to school in terms of resources is the curriculum design and course materials.
Yeah, some schools are, well, I would say that all of the places where I've taught, everyone has always been very generous in sharing their materials with me. One thing I like at the school where we both teach is that the program is very structured with the three levels. And so as far as curriculum design, it's already sort of pre-established, you know, what you're going to be doing at each level. And it's helpful if you have a syllabus from a previous instructor, but even if you don't, you have a general idea of what you're going to be teaching.
Right. Well, at the same time, having freedom to do what you want to do. If there's an activity you want to bring to class, it's not completely set in stone.
Absolutely, yeah, of course.
So I do like that about it. I have taught at places before where I've had to basically develop the curriculum from scratch. Even though there may be other sections of the same class, everybody kind of does it their own way. And so that was kind of a learning curve for me because I had been so spoiled where I had come into these situations where books had already been purchased and the curriculum and rough draft of the syllabus had been put together. And so, you know, I just kind of had to alter what was already there. But in the example I'm talking about, I had to come up with everything. And, you know, that takes a considerable amount of work. It absolutely took me, you know, a really long time to choose different readings and kind of make sure that they all flow well together and all kind of addressed a very specific topic that we were working on. So you never really know going into the situation if you're going to have things set up for you already or how much development's going to be required.
Yeah, I have to say that the situation you just described, on the one hand, sounds really fun and interesting if that were the only class you were teaching. But it's really unreasonable to think that you can devote that much time to one class when you're teaching other classes. And if you're having to come up with a curriculum for a class, then that class is sort of getting an unfair amount of your attention. One thing that I like about both places where I teach is that resources are always made available to me online. So at the one school, there's an ESL forum on our Blackboard website. So I can log into Blackboard and see the courses that I teach, but I can also log in and click on this ESL forum, and there are folders of syllabi and exercises and different resources created for the different classes so that I can go in there and borrow whatever I need.
Right. Yeah, that is nice, and I love an environment of collaboration.
Yeah, and at the other school where I teach, I've recently learned how to use Dropbox, which is a wonderful resource, and I love it, but I was a little bit confused by it at first. I didn't know that if something was made available to you in Dropbox that you had to accept it.
Ah.
So I was sort of expecting it to just appear in my Dropbox, but I had to accept these materials before they could appear in my Dropbox. Yeah. And then the other thing that I learned the hard way was that if you remove something from Dropbox, it's removed from everyone's Dropbox. So if I take something from Dropbox and copy it onto my flash drive, or if I move it onto my flash drive, rather, then whoever shared it with me is also losing it. So I had to learn to be careful not to take anything, but right, just to copy and paste.
I see. Yeah, I do like Dropbox, and I used it quite a bit when I worked in the management communication lab because we would have a lot of students come in to work on impromptu speeches. And so they would have an impromptu speech that was a minute to 2 minutes long, and I would record it. And then from the lab, I could just send it to them, because if you try to send something like that via email, it's usually too large and it doesn't send very well. And so I really liked using Dropbox for that, for those purposes.
Yeah, I do that also. I'm teaching a class this semester where students have to give speeches. It's a presentation skills class for medical students, and so they have to give speeches, and I record them and put them in Dropbox so that they can watch their speeches, evaluate their strengths and weaknesses, and work to improve. And you know all this, of course, because you helped me figure out how to do that in Dropbox. So
right.
Thank you.
No problem. So anything else you would add to different resources that?
Well, I think that one thing that you mentioned earlier was libraries and how every school website has different resources on their library homepage. So at the one school where we both teach, there are a lot of really wonderful databases which come in handy when students have to do research projects like they do in my class. Or there's videos on demand which come in handy if they have to do journals, listening journals like in your class. So I really love our library website.
I love that. And I sometimes will just watch videos for fun.
I have done that so also when it's wonderful. Slow in the tutoring office.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you take a little break while you're having your lunch and put on a video about your favorite, I don't know, favorite period of history. And
definitely.
Good to go. So great, great. Well, I want to give a few shout outs if we can. I'd like to give my first shout out to English Expressions. We've been chatting a bit on Twitter, and I appreciate your humor. Also, Rolls Off the Tongue. And I love on Rolls Off the Tongue, their little icon picture is a picture of these really scrumptious looking rolls.
I love like a good food.
So I love it, and I wanted to give you guys shout-outs. Thanks for following us, and I look forward to, you know, continuing these fun conversations we've been having.
Also, we wanted to count down how many days until we leave for TESOL. So I don't know if we mentioned before that we're going to Portland in March for the TESOL conference, and we're really excited. We're leaving on March 26th, so that is 30 days from today. And we're starting the countdown.
Yes.
Portland, here we come.
30 days. And I don't want to give out too much information too soon. But if you come and find us, there may be a prize involved. So look for us at TESOL this year.
Also, not to give any false hope, but if things go according to plan, we'll be doing a show from Portland. We'll be recording an episode from the TESOL conference.
Yes.
Just kind of sharing our experience and how it's going for us.
And if the show doesn't pan out, we might just be playing some Taboo. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll definitely be doing that in the hotel room.
Get a Taboo game going. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. So you know where to find us on Twitter, at The Minimal Pair. And also like us on our Facebook page. We give a lot of updates there as well.
Don't hesitate to email us with suggestions and feedback. We love to hear from you. We're still really new at this, so anything that you have to share with us will help us do better in the future.
All right. So until next time, keep it minimal.